Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is audio from a webinar sponsored by and held at the International Action Center in New York City on March 5, 2026. The title is Building Solidarity with the Iranian Resistance, and we'll start with Larry Holmes, First Secretary of the Workers' World Party and a prominent activist in socialist, anti-war, and anti-racist causes. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Good evening, comrades. There are many around the world, not only in West Asia, and even amongst, you know, the imperialists, who believe that Iran is winning and that already this war is turning out to be catastrophic for U.S. imperialism and for Israel. This is very encouraging. It's very early, as you all know, less than a week since the war began. I will defer to other speakers to chime in on those thoughts, as well as the many, many issues. What's next? How is this going to affect the global economy? So many issues. I just want to make a few key points for the discussion. Comrades, this is clearly a pivotal moment that can be said about so many things, but it surely can be said about this moment. It is going to change the world struggle in ways that we can only speculate about. But that speculation justifiably includes another step downwards in the decline of U.S. imperialism, whether that is appreciated today, tomorrow, sooner than later, that is inevitable. It also clarifies some things. I think for many of us, it was already clear, but as simple as this, opposing war is absolutely essential. Opposing imperialism, absolutely essential. But a section of the movement, and a section that is growing and becoming stronger and more united, has to be in favor and act accordingly for the goal of destroying U.S. imperialism, not just opposing it, destroying it. Clearly, U.S. imperialism is not only an oppressor, an enslaver, a colonizer, it is an existential threat to the planet. Beyond oppression and colonialism and getting in the way of liberation, it's a threat to the survival of the planet. I think more people, regardless of their consciousness politically, are beginning to realize it, and it will move them. We have been discussing this. Everybody who is anti-imperialist, seriously anti-imperialist, on many levels, organizations and comrades who have been around, like me, as well as new young forces, been talking about this. But it's time for the talk to produce some concrete results. We need a united front against imperialism. We need a front that is ideological, that has an ideological anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, pro-revolutionary, pro-liberation, pro-resistance view. It's so heartening that some of the comrades are organizing a commemoration to Ayatollah Khamenei tomorrow. And I hope it's well attended. You don't have to agree with the Iranian leadership ideologically. You have to be in solidarity with their resistance, their militant, brave resistance to U.S. imperialism and the Zionist entity. And you have to commemorate the martyrs, all of them, whose names I think they're putting on missiles and drones. We need a front that, of course, opposes the war, but we need a front that very clearly, and I'm making the point as best as I can, so it's not just dismissed as rhetoric. Not that that's a bad thing, but I say this not rhetorically, not just as an applause line. We need a front that's for defeating U.S. imperialism, straight out, for defeating it, ASAP. And our politics and our tactics should be informed by that. If we were in Iraq, we would be with the people who are shutting down the U.S. consulate. If we were in Pakistan, we would, you know, be with those who are shutting down the consulate. I mean, there's demonstrations all around the world, not just in West Asia. I was just seeing a video about a big demonstration in Rio in Brazil, where they were marching on the consulate and trying to shut it down. We need a front that is in solidarity with the rebellion in the global South, which has many contradictions, from the liberation struggles, communists and nationalists, to the bourgeois regimes who are with it to a certain extent because they're tired of U.S. economic and military hegemony. But we need to be clearly in solidarity with them. I think there's a perception, and it's an old perception, that such a revolutionary united front is not conceivable. It can't be strong. It would tend to be marginal. And I disagree with that. I think we're in a different time. I think the world has evolved. I think the global South is winning the struggle to marginalize and ultimately vanquish, prevail over U.S. imperialism. And moreover, the global South cannot just be defined geographically. It exists here. It exists everywhere. It exists in the centers of U.S. imperialism, wherever oppressed people are, wherever Black and Brown and Indigenous people are. That's the global South. They can, you know, they can kick out people. They can do their crazy stuff to, you know, for a white supremacist country, but it's not going to work. It's too late. The ship has sailed. The imperialists are surrounded, both from without and also from within. This is a front that must get its leadership from oppressed people, along with communists and revolutionary and serious anti-imperialists. And comrades, just back to the question of how long we've been talking about this and maybe arguing about it. Well, that will continue, you know, I suppose. Well, of necessity. But I think we have to get serious about it. Building a united front is both urgent, obviously, but it's also a serious and patient process. It's a long-term project that will go through phases. And none of that should be daunting. The world is dependent on us here in what we call the belly of the beast to do this. And if we allow anything to get in the way of doing this, consciously, unwittingly or not, we're not shouldering our responsibility. We're not standing up. And so we must not allow anything, however long it takes, we must not allow anything to get in the way at this point of whatever we need to do to forge a revolutionary anti-imperialist united front that is class, that has a global class view. I should add that there is another political and social base for opposition to the war. This is a complex base. It's not ideological. It's based in materialism. That's, you know, from the perspective of workers who will suffer, soldiers who will die. I mean, it bothers me when they talk about, you know, U.S. soldiers being killed. You know, we're against that. But what about the thousands of Iranians that are being killed? What about the people in Gaza? You know, when the bourgeois media makes something big out of that, it's dehumanizing. It's as if the victims of the war, the real victims,
don't matter.
I'm sure I'm not the only one that bothers. But, you know, the toll of U.S. soldiers, the economic toll, the people are already against the war, and it's going to increase that opposition to the war. And I don't think we should have a hostile view of this. It's important. I don't think we should oppose it. I think we should try to win those in this movement who are open to a more revolutionary perspective. And I think we have to be with this movement. I think the important thing in terms of our approach to this movement is to distinguish classes. We speak to workers one way, but we speak to the bourgeois opposition to the war, which is not real opposition. They're for imperialism. They're just against us for tactical or strategic reasons. You know, they think it was a mistake, but they're not really against it. You know, and how we deal with them is different. But how we deal with the masses, with progressives, with the working class, that's different. We must talk to them in a different way. And it's important to get that in order to be effective, which is what we want to be. I think that's pretty much what I have to say. Just remember about the mass opposition. The Iranians, who clearly have prepared for this and are ready to fight, they are also dependent on mass opposition here in this country and around the world. They're dependent on it to weaken imperialism politically and play a role in forcing them to stop. We understand that, and we are for that. And that doesn't obviate or mitigate or change our differences with the bourgeois leadership, in some cases, of the larger anti-war movement. Anyway, comrades, thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is audio from a webinar sponsored by and held at the International Action Center in New York City on March 5th, 2026. The title is Building Solidarity with the Iranian Resistance, and we just heard Larry Holmes, first secretary of the Workers' World Party and a prominent activist in socialist, anti-war, and anti-racist causes. Next up is Sunday, an activist with Arm the Dolls, an organization which provides clear, accessible information about firearm ownership, concealed carry permits, and related issues to trans people across the United States.
My name is Sunday from Arm the Dolls. Arm the Dolls is a Marxist-Leninist group based right here in New York City. Our focus is on Black and brown trans women, and we hope to improve and educate Black and brown trans women through political ways, improve them materially as well, and physically as well. I have a short statement written by the Fem Queen Council, as we call it, our organizing committee. Over the past week, we have lost another 1,000 people, martyrs to American imperialism. This includes over 165 Iranian schoolgirls, nurses, doctors, political officials, and of course, the blessed Ayatollah Khamenei. Hundreds have been martyred in Lebanon, as well as hundreds of thousands displaced from the South, and may they all rest in peace. At the very same time, trans Americans have continued to have their human rights stripped away. Kansas has taken state-issued identification away from their trans residents. NYU, Langone, Mount Sinai, and so many more hospitals continue to shut down their trans healthcare programs, specifically utilized by youth and Black and brown women. Trans migrants have been continuing to be disappeared by ICE and DHS from their families and communities, leaving little trace of where they are are what their conditions are. Prisons across the nation have shut down trans healthcare to incarcerated people, leaving women such as Gia Abigail Valentina, who recently underwent vaginoplasty surgery, without hormones to heal her body. Just for those that don't know, this could kill her. She doesn't make hormones herself anymore. This could kill her. All of these are examples of sicknesses of the most malignant kind, that is U.S. imperialism. This is why we, at Arm the Dolls, unequivocally stand in solidarity with the people of Iran, Lebanon, and Palestine, as well as the brave axis of resistance that is fighting for their nation's sovereignty. This is why we call for the destruction of Western imperialism. This is why we rejoice at the IRGC striking down U.S. military bases spread out across the Gulf, as well as settler colonial states of the Zionist entity. While our brothers and sisters are simultaneously strangled in nations from the global South, we are strangled here in the imperial core. We are both being strangled by the same entity, but we must do our part for them and for us. We must unite based upon the primary contradictions to take steps towards the liberation of humanity. Like the great martyr, Hassan Kanafani, brilliantly put, imperialism has laid its body over the world, the head in Eastern Asia, the heart in the Middle East, its arteries reaching Africa and Latin America. Wherever you strike it, you damage it, and you serve the world revolution. As those surviving in the belly of the beast, we must strike against imperialism daily. It is our duty to do so. If we are able to take upon this calling and our comrades and the global South continue to resist heroically, we will eventually liberate one another. And this is with love and solidarity from all of us at Arm the Dolls. Thank you again.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard from Sunday, an activist with Arm the Dolls, an organization which provides clear, accessible information about firearm ownership, concealed carry permits, and related issues to trans people across the United States. Next up is Omawale Clay, a veteran New York City-based political activist, organizer, and spokesperson for the December 12th Movement, a Black human rights organization.
I wanted our comrades to be informed more about what's happening. Certainly, we have peripheral understandings of what's happening in Iran. You cannot help that. But I think, as Comrade Holmes said, one of the things that's very important now is for those of us who are revolutionary, those of us who are conscious, it's important the presentation of the question of what's going on now. And our understanding, and we've gotten some solidarity with that, listening to some of our comrades in Africa, is that we're in a period where, and I think as Larry said, it's a downward motion, but it's not a downward motion in the revolutionary essence of what's happening. Imperialism is at its weakest stage, and is to appreciate that this stage also makes them the most vicious. But that viciousness only exposes the very nature of who they are, even to the horror of some of their allies. And so it's important, as we see every day, it seems like something else is happening, where there's another right being taken away, another child is being kidnapped, and all this is going on. This is actually a sign of weakness, because in this period, their best weapon is to not be exposed and to be able to continue to fool people into convincing them that things are actually getting better. So we feel good in this period, even as vicious and as horrid as it is, because we think the people are winning. And I think that's important. So now it gives a responsibility. And that's why I wanted comrades to hear what's happening this evening and hear Al-Houd's Day, the Ayatollah, to understand that this is part of the fabric of the revolutionary motion in the world. And it passes through these changes, and we lose and martyr folks in that process. And in our own motion and in our solidarity with other comrades and countries and movements, we lose people. And that is a part of the process of changing this world. And I think right now, it might seem in one sense that things seem so difficult, but yet we are presented with a great opportunity at this point. They have touched Iran. Iran is not a small island somewhere. It's 90 million people. And they've gone into it for all of the different tactical and strategic reasons they want to. But at the same time, they are also awakening another part of the world to the resistance to imperialism. And I say this around the question of imperialism because the class contradictions in the Black community, say in particular, are something that we must pay particular attention to if we're going to make sure that our national right to liberation does not become confused. That anti-imperialism can easily be motioned into being alliances to imperialism if the wrong forces are in the front of it. And so I've said that we see it extremely important for the December 12th movement to do our work inside our community, where over a period of time, the class forces that are influencing the Black liberation struggle have really turned against progress in that regard. And, you know, they say, tell, as Cabral said, tell no lies and claim no easy victories in that regard. There's work, very serious work that needs to be done. And we've lost many comrades that have been steeled in the sense of our history and our motion and our experience in that regard. And we have to rebuild that. We have to win over another generation of young people to let them know what their role is in this period right now. Some of us will not be here going forward, but we must fight for a legacy that transforms and transfers that experience, that commitment to another generation. As one of our young comrades said, intergenerational solidarity is so critical now that there are new things, but because they're new don't make them right. They're old things because they're old. That doesn't make them correct. It is the experience and knowledge to be able to understand that which can serve revolution and that which opposes revolution has to be identified in that regard. And so where we are now, I think, is a very critical period, particularly for many of us who've been together over many years. I look in this room and I see people that we smile when we see each other because we know each other, because we've been in an experience over decades, not days and months and years, but decades. And we say to ourselves, at this point in time, our greatest contribution is the optimism, is revolutionary optimism. That's one of our most critical things to be able to see. And that's what ideology gives us. That's what politics gives us. It gives us the ability to see the road ahead, even in the greatest difficulties, to see weakness when what's being advocated by the enemy is strength, to see strength when they try to undermine and say we're at the weakest point in our lives in that regard. So my comrade Roger, we've been together on 50 years. You know, we wanted to come down because the idea of the front is extremely important. But, you know, to build the front, the question is, what are the components that are going to go into it? And that's a very, very important question. because as you build the party, as we build our movement, its strength is tied very much to what the strength of the front would be. And if we're weak in that, then how could not the front be weak in that? Because a front is very interesting territory, because it's unity and then a conscious understanding of actual disunity on many issues. But the question is, how do we arrive at the things that we can aim against imperialism? We find sometimes in this country of personalities and individualism, sometimes personalities and character separate the building of a front. It's not deep ideology. No, it's personalities. You know, I don't like you. You know, I don't want to be away from you. I don't understand. You know, these things actually have a material impact on ultimately, Larry, do we pull that front together? And we sit and say it's necessary to make it so. But the reality of making it so means it's not just something we read. It's the real experience of, you know, everybody comes from where they are, where they say, you make revolution where you are, and that's your contribution to world revolution. You contribute to it from where you are in terms of, as the Cubans say, our socialism has palm trees. You know, the essence of that is it has to apply and speak to our actual conditions. And that's what I think we're challenged with now. You know, sometimes I say to folks, and I say to my comrades, yes, we go to Union Square. Yes, we go to Times Square. But we have to go to the Bronx. We got to go to the heart of Bed-Stuy. We got to go to East New York. We have to take ourselves there so that people see the reality of what a revolutionary movement is. It's not a television question. It's a question of people actually seeing and feeling a different level of unity. So, you know, the December 12th movement is here for the go down. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I know Sarah said, "Oh, Wally, y'all going to be da 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 da." I said, "Sarah, we're coming and da 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 da." Many tasks cry out to be done, all urgently in that regard. But we have to build the time for building the front. We have to pay particular attention to what the building blocks will be if there's going to be longevity and strength to it. Sarah doesn't remember this, but Sarah came back from China, and she came back and she made a statement that I thought was extremely powerful. She said when she was there, she was doing an article in a newspaper. And in the article, she formulated, she said, you know, one of the most important things to understand about the bourgeoisie, and it's sobering, they don't see a world that they're not in charge of. You have to understand that to understand how dangerous they are. And I've never forgotten that statement, Sarah.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is audio from a webinar sponsored by and held at the International Action Center in New York City on March 5th, 2026. The title is Building Solidarity with the Iranian Resistance, and we just heard Omawali Clay, a veteran New York City-based political activist, organizer, and spokesperson for the December 12th Movement, a Black human rights organization. Next up is Sarah Flounders, director of the International Action Center.
Well, I'm going to start with Omawali's revolutionary optimism, because if we're not optimists, and if the whole resistance movement isn't, and especially at this moment, then we'll miss what's really happening. Now, it's a world-changing event, as Larry described. It's ripping apart everything, and it's bringing every political contradiction just roaring to the front. Here in the U.S., it will transform workers' consciousness. Wars do that. Wars really do that. Things change fast. Now, the Iranian Revolution was one of those great, huge, historic upheavals 1979, it ripped apart the U.S. main outpost in the entire region, the key place. And it was an upheaval that drove the U.S. out, broke the back of the military. It was really transformative. In many ways, that was 1979, like the Great Chinese Revolution in 1949. Different, but it was an upheaval that broke imperialist hold, and it was thoroughgoing down to the very root. And the U.S. has spent decades with sanctions, with assassinations, with wars, with all kinds of regime change. How do they destroy Iran? They're just determined about it. There's never been a good word about it. There's never been a moment of peace. Now, internationally, and especially throughout West Asia, it's explosive what's happened, because this stage of the war began with the worst insult and outrage you can imagine. To assassinate this highly respected religious and political leader in a political blow that was like a sneak attack, we're having negotiations, take this back and discuss it. And not only the Ayatollah Khamenei, but 49 of the top political and military leaders lost in one blast. That's really quite a hit. Killed in the most duplicitous way. Now, the U.S. thought, just like they thought they could just kidnap President Maduro and Celia Flores and everything would fall apart. So let's look at how it's going. How's this war going? Well, the CIA took a direct hit in the Saudi capital. According to the Washington Post, an Iranian drone struck the CIA station inside the U.S. embassy compound in Riyadh. IRGC, they really exposed some weaknesses. This is the U.S. main spy hub. It's a heart of the U.S. intelligence infrastructure for the whole Gulf, and it's inside the most fortified diplomatic compound of one of the most U.S. most important centers. It's right in the Saudi capital. Iran sent a drone through their defenses. The embassy is now closed. The consular services are all canceled. They tell everyone they should evacuate, but there are no plans on how to tell you to do that. And they even disconnected the phone number. That's not much help. A drone struck the consulate in Dubai and the embassy in Kuwait. Both have been shut down indefinitely. They hit the embassy in Jordan's capital, had to be evacuated. The embassy in Lebanon, how's it going? 4 U.S. diplomatic missions hit, closed, evacuated in the first 72 hours. So is the U.S. winning this war? Now, the U.S. way of fighting wars, we know this Vietnam, we know it Korea, we know it Iraq, is to target the civilians. And this they are doing. It is ruthless. But they're having lots of discussions about their stockpiles because these drones bother them. A drone costs, on the average, for every $50 the U.S. spends or $100 the U.S. spends on a multi-million dollar drone, Iran spends about $1. And they're making thousands of them. U.S. can only produce a certain number of their missiles in a year. So even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff apparently warned Trump that, you know, an extensive campaign has some serious risks, including depletion of their own munitions and their own stockpiles. So these cheap drones are another example of what's happening in the world in terms of changing technology, and it can be a real equalizing force. Let's keep that in mind, and we certainly saw it in Gaza. In tunnels, in hand-manufactured arms. So you have diplomatic missions hit, closed, evacuated, people told to flee, and no evacuation plans, no even 24-hour hotlines. And this is an empire collapsing. Its war is not doing so well. There is no plan. Every press conference, they ask president and any of the advisors, well, what's the plan? What comes after? they can't even cook up an artificial answer. At any rate, we could go on, talk about Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, all these hundreds of drones, the Iraqis hitting Erbil and in Iraqi Kurdistan, explosions at the U.S. air base in Jordan, which where the majority of actually the U.S. aircraft are based, and the main U.S. radar for the whole area is in Qatar. It got hit. It doesn't exist anymore. They're having real problems. The big U.S. Navy fuel depot in Bahrain, that's where the, you know, Navy is, was hit. And then we could look, I could go on all night about what's being hit in the Zionist center itself. And now Ansarullah has come in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon into the struggle pretty actively. The Straits of Hormuz are closed. Now, what's the Straits of Hormuz? We showed it at the beginning. This is the world's most critical energy checkpoint. It handles roughly a fifth of global crude oil and LNG shipments and so on. So there's a desperate effort by the U.S. imperialism to reverse by military means what they can no longer accomplish with economic productivity. They are in a real bind, and they're trying to like gun their way out of it. And yet they know even more than we do that they are in complete decline. So they hope an all-out war is going to reverse that, and it can't be accomplished. Sanctions, war, tariffs won't return them to the position of the world of today. It won't succeed. But what it is accomplishing is really inflaming the people of the whole region who now are striking back in more and more ways. It's pretty incredible. We're only getting little bits of the news. Really, it's so little. You can comb through and you don't even know the impact. This hit, this is no longer functioning. This is evacuated. What does that mean in terms of the U.S. empire? So there's a resistance at every level. And there's a deep feeling that the population of all these areas, you could look at what's happening in Bahrain, where the majority of the population is totally for Iran, is Shia, against a feudal ruling class. You can see it in Palestine, of course. Now, by the way, China is giving aid in some of the most interesting ways. You know, the satellite maps that you could look in the whole world, anybody could see your own home address and see the license plate on your car, just put in an address. Except when it comes to any U.S. base or consulate or embassy anywhere in the world, and it's just a gray shadow. They've just taken it away. You can't see what's there. So China has just released a whole series of satellite maps that show every location in the world, including every base, every little container in the base, just as clear as a license plate. And it's released not just to Iran. No, no. Let's make this accessible to the whole world. Now, I think there are even some U.S. soldiers that are going to be thinking about that. I mean, what does that mean in terms of safe space? It was only safe as long as it was protected. So they don't have that anymore. So I'll just sort of wind up on this because there's an explosive movement that's happening globally and coming here. And it wakes up not only the working class, but there are different factions in the ruling class. And that's important. And look at the Democratic Party. Now, they want to claim they're against this war. So they're going to push a vote on the War Powers Act, on the War Powers Act. Now, they went into it knowing they weren't going to get the vote. And even if they got the vote, would it end the war? Any war? Has it ever ended a war? War Powers Act just says we want to be part of the crime. That's really all it's saying. You got to consult us before you go in. And there's no real criticism of it, but it enables them to say, you know, we're not part of this. Now, there are big demonstrations also saying stop the war. And here in the imperialist center, it's always determined, you know, the class conscious forces are smaller in number, those that dare to defend the country under attack. What we say, the anti-imperialist movement, what does that mean? There's a real current in anti-war movements here that says these are our siblings, our sisters and brothers over there. And we have no interest in this war. That's really what an anti-imperialist current is. It's a class-conscious current. It's a consciousness that is global. And who is under attack, feeling with it, defending it. And I think our role, modest, has been over decades to side, to be heart and soul for the Vietnamese and for Korea and for Iraq and for Syria, Palestine, always. You think of every one of these countries under attack, and there'd be folks that say, well, not this war, or let's have sanctions and not war, and let's do it this way instead of that. It's a current that wants to still hedge their bets and be with the established order. It's not easy, I will say, to be an opponent of U.S. imperialist wars on a class-conscious basis. Lots of well-funded groups. But I want to give an example, because here's a group that's having a lot of influence right now in the movement. It's called the National Iranian American Council, NIAC. And they have a view of no bombing and no sanctions, except some sanctions. They say, oh, we're for targeted sanctions, not general sanctions. NIAC is important. They're speaking at all the demonstrations. They spoke on Saturday, the only Iranian speaker, and half their talk was, while saying we're against the bombing, here's 10 reasons why you should hate the current government and side with the, quote, democracy movement and those thousands of Starlinks that were dropped. And is that the message we want to bring to the anti-war movement? It's a dual, confusing, disorienting message. So it matters who your allies are. It matters, are your allies those who are going to say, we stand with not only Ayatollah Khamenei, but with the people of Iran and their right to resist. And we have nothing in common with the U.S. government, and we're not going to tell them how to run their empire, that they shouldn't bomb, but they should try to overthrow the Iranian government through democratic means, through democratic demonstrations. No, no, no. That is the kind of disorienting. And it also is the reason why there is a whole focus. And now I think there's up to 100 groups who are calling out for actions on Al-Quds Day, because Al-Quds Day stands for Palestinian resistance and Iranian resistance and the right to resist. That's what it was called for. Here, let's have a day, the last Friday of every Ramadan, that is for resistance to U.S. imperialism. So that's our choice. Even which part of the Iranian movement are we with? Are we with those Iranians fighting, dying, struggling, resisting in Iran? Are we with those who came here and are the royalists or the business people or the lobbyists, very well funded, good salaries, but they want to really be with the U.S. empire?
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard Sarah Flounders, director of the International Action Center. Next up is Bahman Azad, an Iranian-American peace and justice activist living in the United States.
Thank you for inviting me to this important meeting, and very timely and crucial for mobilizing some efforts to counter what the criminal process the United States and Israel have started, not just in the Middle East and West Asia, but throughout the world, actually. As we know, these criminal actions, including the assassination of the supreme leader of Iran, who was really beloved by the people, and it was through his wise leadership that Iran survived four decades of sanctions and war and assassinations and everything. And we owe a lot of it to his wisdom and his understanding of the history and understanding of imperialism. So it was a big loss to all of the Iranians, including myself. And we are hoping that somebody, the next leader, would be exactly following the same line that Ayatollah Khamenei was pursuing against imperialism and Zionism and in favor of resistance. The question is, the problem we are facing today in terms of the crimes committed against Iran and against all masses of the region are a result of desperate effort by U.S. imperialism that is losing its hegemony to kind of save its deteriorating domination of the world. And in that process, they have come to realize that the loss of the Middle East and West Asia, especially after the October 7th uprising of Palestinian people, and after the whole resistance movement in the region gained some victories, they realized that they are losing their control of the Middle East, and the loss of Middle East would be the end of their hegemony throughout the world, because this is a crucial area of the world that its loss would mean the loss of imperialist control of the whole world. And in that sense, if you look at it, the attack, criminal attack that started left and right on the struggle of the Palestinian liberation, on Syria, on Lebanon, on Iran now, are all part and parcel of this putting an end to the resistance movement in order to prevent the fall of the control of the region. And I would say that they attempted several ways. You remember the 12-day war. They did those agitations in terms of the uprising, so-called, by their own agents inside the country. And since both of them failed, the last anniversary of Iranian Revolution this year was much larger in terms of popular support than any other year before that. And after that fake uprising that they created inside the country, the following day of that uprising, so-called uprising, 30 million people of Iran, that's one-third of the whole population of the country, were demonstrating throughout the country in support of the government. So they realized that if they allow this to go on, they're going to be losing the whole thing. The only way, and we know that, as Comrade Sarah mentioned, they are not going to be able to battle or fight or compete economically, politically, diplomatically, even morally these days. The only means left to them to try to save their losing control is military means. And that is how they decided that they should do it. And just to as an extra in parentheses point, I would like to say that I get a feeling that the attack on Venezuela was, in fact, there was a precursor on an attack on Iran, because they knew that with this war starting in the Middle East, probably supply of oil would be diminished from the region to many of these countries. The facilities will be hit. The Hormuz Strait will be shut down. And as a result, there will be an energy crisis or oil crisis somewhere. So they tried to first tap on the Venezuelans' oil before they could start this war. So in a sense, if you look at it, this imperialist attack is not just targeting Iran, but it's targeting the whole global South. And its purpose is, in fact, to get to China and Russia and put an end to the transition to a multipolar world. And all these crimes, and we should not sit down and think, even if this battle with Iran, this war, is somehow settled down, this is going to be the end of it. We are in a war situation for a long haul, as long as imperialists are going to resist their own downfall and commit to more and more criminal actions or acts to save their own lot. So what I'm trying to say is that we need not just a reaction to what the U.S. is doing right now, but we need a long-term strategic approach, as Comrade Larry mentioned. We need a long-term approach to creation of a united front, and this united front has to be global, not just in the U.S. Has to be global, and it has to be an anti-imperialist front, not just anti-war, anti-imperialist front, anti-Zionist front throughout the world to overcome this whole criminal gang that is now trying to suffocate humanity altogether. So we are all in this together, and we are in a long run right now. And I think, as a final point, as a precondition for creating a united front in the United States, at least, what we need is to start process of negotiation, discussion with all anti-imperialist forces in the U.S. to come to terms in terms of agreeing on a common platform of struggle against imperialism, both from national point of view and international point of view. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Building Solidarity with the Iranian Resistance, and we just heard Bahman Azad, an Iranian-American peace and justice activist living in the United States. The audio was from a webinar sponsored by and held at the International Action Center in New York City on March 5, 2026. We'll close with a song written and performed by activist-songwriter Ben Groskop called The Money They Stole, followed by a short piece written by Caitlin Johnstone and read by Tim Foley called Meditations on a Delivery Robot Steering to Avoid a Homeless Man on the Sidewalk. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.
Troops are banging at the door. Will they dare to start a war? Venezuela faces its gravest hour since Bolivar fought the Spanish power. Fishermen have been burned and drowned by orders of a man donning a crown, peddling sinister fentanyl lies, posting snuff films of the people who die. And if you wonder what's the empire's goal, just follow the money they stole. The assets have been seized by banks that act like thieves. Western leaders say they should decide how a sovereign country runs inside. When they lose sway, they cook up a scheme to make the economy scream. Washington claims it owns the oil in the open veins of Venezuela's soil. And if you wonder, just follow the money they stole. The veins were drained by foreign theft. The vampires blame the country's left and plot a coup to strip and steal the wealth of a nation refusing to kneel. The people there are standing guard, 'cause Yankees act like it's their backyard. The U.S. fleet surrounds the shore where an empire met defeat before. And if you wonder what's the empire's goal, just children and their families. The money they stole, the money they stole, and put it in their banks. The money they stole, the money they stole, they took the Citgo stations. The money they stole, the money they stole, that once sustained the nation. The money they stole, the money they stole, the people will reclaim it. The money they stole, the money they stole, but first we have to name it. Just follow the money they stole.
Meditations on a delivery robot steering to avoid a homeless man on the sidewalk. I saw a video of a food delivery robot navigating around the body of a homeless person lying on the sidewalk, and I can't stop thinking about it. This video is as close to a self-portrait of Western civilization as it gets. This is who we are. This is where we're at. Might as well have giant letters with a big red arrow saying, "You are here," over top it. It captures so perfectly the creepy dance between suffering, apathy, frivolity, and corporate profiteering that makes our particular dystopia so distinctive in just a few short seconds of footage. This is the dance that makes the empire go round. It's got everything. A man splayed out on the concrete because it hurts to be human in this global ghost town. And because he was unsuccessful at becoming a productive gear turner in the capitalist machine, and because social safety nets have been stripped bare in order to help millionaires become billionaires. Automation being used to eliminate workers' wages for the maximization of corporate profits, when it could be getting used to bring about a permanent end to toil and poverty for the entire human species. Technological innovations stagnating at fast food delivery robots and predatory service apps instead of inventions which help save our biosphere, provide for the needful, heal the sick, and improve our quality of life. Because sending someone a Big Mac and a snack bot through an app will generate profits, while making the world a better place will not. The machine calmly navigating around the unfortunate soul on the pavement in the same way all the human pedestrians have been doing all day, because that's what we learn to do in a society which casts those who can't keep up to the side of the road like so much refuse. This is where we are. This is what we have become. That robot steering its way around that man on the sidewalk is revealing more truth about the kind of world we are living in than you will ever receive from the corporate news media. That robot has the real story. That robot is giving you the real on-the-ground scoop on what's really going on here. That robot is a better reporter than Jake Tapper. It certainly has more journalistic integrity. We're all following that robot off a cliff into an abyss of madness and oblivion.